Hello. Today we start a new sermon series, Faith in a Time of Crisis. And the world really is in a crisis at the moment with the coronavirus spreading around the globe. This week, the death toll from the coronavirus exceeded 300,000 lives, which is such a tragedy, such a tragic statistic to hear. In addition to the human toll, our economies are suffering, and at an individual level, people suffer in isolation and many have lost employment. So it truly is a crisis for the world. Now, of course, amidst all of that, there are some good news stories. It's been wonderful to hear some lovely things, some lovely simple neighbourliness that's happening in lockdown. It's been great to hear about our valiant first responders and medical personnel, and it's been great also to hear from our scientific community as they work hard to discover, create a vaccine for this virus. So the world is in a crisis, and for some there's fear and anxiety, but for all of us a sense of sadness and grief at what is happening to our world. So we start this new series, and today we want to look at the role of faith in a crisis where we're very dependent on our scientists. We can't get enough of our scientific news. A couple of months ago, none of us knew what a coronavirus looked like, and now we all know. And we read all the reports, we read about things which seem to be making people more susceptible to the virus, things which make people more resistant to it. So in a context where we're so dependent on our scientists, what role does faith play? And of course, that speaks to the deeper issue of how faith and science relate altogether. Well, I'm no scientist, but I thought I would read the testimony of a scientist, and I'm going to read to you from the ABC website, an article that they wrote where there's a testimony by a Dr. Jennifer Wiseman. What a great surname she's got. As a child, Jennifer grew up in Arkansas on a farm in the US, and she said the skies were very dark and there was an amazing array of stars. And at the same time, around that time, NASA was sending the Voyager spacecraft to the outer planets of the solar system and sending back these amazing photos. And she was just like, I'm going to be a part of that. And so she's grown up to study and now work mostly with telescopes and to study how stars and planets are made. And she discovered the comet Wiseman Skiff in 1987. Now she says, there are at least 200 billion stars in our own galaxy, and there are maybe 400 billion galaxies in our observable universe, each one of them with billions of stars. She goes on to say, those of us who study astronomy can tell you the numbers and all of that, but comprehending it is something totally different. And she says, while science is a wonderful tool for understanding the physical universe, she says that her religious beliefs give her the answers to the bigger philosophical questions in life, like how mere humans can be significant in all the context of this big universe. And the article goes on as well to interview Dr. Andrew Harmon, who is a Buddhist immunologist, and also Fahad Ali, who is a Muslim geneticist, all of them talking about how their faith and their religion work beautifully together, not only in their vocation, but in their larger life. Well, you know, these are interesting testimonies because the popular press would have us believe that there's this constant drama, power narrative going on between science and religion. And in our world where we're used to sound bites and slogans, we can start to believe some of the things we hear about how science has disproved religion or science is in a battle with religion. The truth is a lot more complex than that. And one scientist, Tom McLeish, points out in an article that really the only religion that has been disproven by science is a religion that believes in a God that, you know, hovers over the world like a nanny, like Mary Poppins, you know, like making sure that no one slips or falls, or like a helicopter parent, you know, as soon as something goes wrong, God comes in and rescues us. And if that, of course, well, our science and our lived experience tell us that if there's a God, God is not like that. But that is not the God of the Bible. The God of the Bible is not that kind of hovering God, but a God who created a universe, created a beautiful, ordered universe. So let's have a look at what the Bible says about God and creation and where we fit into all of that, and some of these philosophical questions that it answers. And I'd like to look briefly at the first chapter of the Bible, Genesis chapter 1. You know, in any book, and this is a big book, the Bible, 66 books, and if you miss the first one or two chapters in any book, you know that you've missed important information, because those first chapters lay a foundation, and they introduce the main characters, they give you the context for how this is all going to play itself out. And as we read chapter 1 and 2 and so on of Genesis, they are foundational texts for us. But they're controversial texts as well, and it's kind of hard to read the book of Genesis and its account of creation, because I think we all bring a fair bit of baggage to the account. It's a bit like, you know, if you go to the kitchen sink to wash up, and the sink is so full of dirty dishes that you can't even find the plug to put in to start the work of sorting it all out. It's a bit like that when we come to Genesis, because there is so much here that we have questions about, like, is this a literal account? And, you know, is this a short earth account? And what about evolution? And where are the dinosaurs? And, you know, are we meant to take it literally? So we bring a lot of those sort of issues to the chapter. And I can't address them all in this sermon. I would say I don't think it is literal. I think we should read it literarily, as a piece of literature which was written for us, but not directly to us, because it was written so very long ago. But this text, when we understand the context in which it was written, still has an amazing message for us about the beginnings of our world. It says in the first verse of chapter 1, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. This world, this universe, was made by a creator. There it is in the first sentence, claiming that there is one that stands behind time, was there in the beginning, stands behind perhaps the Big Bang, stands behind evolution and created all. In the third verse we read, "And God said, let there be light." Not only does that tell us about light, but it says God is a speaking God, a God that communicates. "And God said." God is a creative God. Let there be a vault between the waters to separate water from water. And let's call that vault sky, it says. "And there was evening and there was morning the second day. Let the water under the sky be gathered up to one place, and let the dry ground appear. Let the land produce vegetation, seed-bearing plants and trees on the land that bear fruit with seed in it, according to their various kinds." God is creative and God is orderly. God has set up an order in the creation. In verse 25, we read this a number of times in the account, "And God saw what was created, and he saw that it was good." Creation is good. In verse 27, we read, "So God created humankind in his own image." I'm not a big fan of the word "his." But her is no better. God is spirit, but we need a personal pronoun for God. I've tried to just use the word God and not use any pronouns, but it's kind of impossible. And it is terrible. So I'm afraid we're kind of stuck with the masculine pronoun, but forgive me for using it. So it says here, God created humankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. We are made in the image of God. That's such a cryptic phrase. The Latin phrase was imago Dei, and many books have been written trying to understand what it means that humans are created in the image of God. And of course, as we contemplate God and as we understand God's character, and we learn a lot about God's character from Scripture, then we come to understand the very best that we are made to be, what it means to be in the image of God. It says in verse 28, God blessed them and said, be fruitful, increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over the fish in the sea, the birds in the sky, and every living creature. God said, I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth. So here we find God blessing. God is a God of blessing. And God is a God of purpose too. Like, he's created humankind in his image and given us a purpose to work towards the flourishing of the world, to act responsibly, to look after all the earth, the plants, the fruit, the fish, the birds, every living creature. We are accountable for our role in contributing to the flourishing of the world. And then at the end of chapter 1, God saw all that he'd made, and it was very good. That word good or very good repeated throughout. We learn much in that first chapter about creation, about the one who created it, about our purpose, philosophical questions, questions of meaning, if you like, that we find out in Scripture. But what we do see there is that God is a God of who's created this wonderful order. And within that order of creation, the seed-bearing plants, all in their order and so on, within that order, actually, there is quite a lot of freedom, certainly with humankind, quite a lot of autonomy, not many rules, but a lot of freedom. And we pay a price for having that much freedom, whether we're talking about in humanity, because we can make poor choices. There is right and wrong, we learn in those first chapters, and humanity has chosen at times the wrong way. But also freedom in the natural order can lead to consequences as well. So we're made by a creator. Creation is good. God is the creator. Where does a nasty virus like the coronavirus fit into such a view of the world? Sir John Polkinghorne is a theoretical physicist and also an Anglican priest. He jokes that it's sort of like being a vegetarian butcher because the two don't naturally go together, but he is both a scientist and a theologian, and he's able to bring a wonderful perspective to things. And he says that he speaks about how God created natural laws, but also freedom and a universe where chance and interdependence come into play. And that normally those things operate in a very balanced ecosystem. But in a system where there is chance and there is interdependence and so on, nature can take a turn which results in suffering for humanity. And although our current crisis, we talk about it as unprecedented, and yet humanity has suffered so many crises, so many plagues or natural disasters, tsunamis and the like, and we think of smallpox and the Spanish flu, all of these things They come at us all the time. And in terms of viruses, there are, I understand, billions of viruses, and many of them do an amazing job of keeping in check the bacteria, which would take over the world if it was allowed. So viruses, you know, normally are in this balanced system, many of them do a great job. But this little virus, this tiny, almost invisible virus, incredible to think that something so tiny can cause so much havoc to humanity around the entire globe. Well, let's think for a few moments about science. Having looked at the Bible, let's think about science. The origins of scientific inquiry really were within the religious communities, for both good and bad reasons, good and not so good reasons. And the good reasons were that, people of faith wanted to understand this creation that had been made by a good God, and to understand themselves and the universe and the God who made it. And so these sort of motivations, these wonderful spiritual motivations, motivated a lot of early scientific inquiry. So it was within faith communities. But in addition to that, the not so good reason is that religion really held a lot of power at the time as well. So religion was responsible for learning institutions, and so we see, amongst some of the Catholic orders in the Middle Ages, some great scientific discoveries being made. But in those days, religion really held not only religious power but political power as well. During the Enlightenment, of course, a lot of that was challenged, and we see the rising up of the disciplines of science, the discipline of religion, the discipline of politics. But as we look back at the origins, it is a fairly complicated picture. You know, we often hear about Galileo's trial that's put to us as a battle between science and religion and their viewpoints. But in fact, as we read history, it seems that a lot about that trial was to do with a power play between the Pope and Galileo. But those are the origins of science. Science has really made enormous contribution and developed a lot as well, especially in the last 90 years, especially since the invention of the Hubble telescope, when we've discovered so many things. I was privileged to go to a lecture in Melbourne a couple of years ago and to hear from Lawrence Krauss. You may know of Lawrence Krauss because he's quite a public figure. He's an American theoretical physicist and cosmologist, author of some best-selling books, and also Professor Paul Davies, who is a theoretical physicist, a cosmologist and an astrobiologist at Arizona State University, and he's an Australian. I think he's from Adelaide originally. And I came away from this lecture, which was a lot to do with our origins, and the scientists, actually, as well as telling us all the great advances in science, were also humble enough to explain that science has changed its mind about things a fair bit in the last 100 years in terms of our origins. You know, 100 years or so ago, they thought that the universe was infinite. Now they're thinking it's finite, that it had a beginning, and that it will end at some time in the future. Then they thought that space was empty. Now they think it is that it contains energy. So, you know, things have changed. Discoveries have been made. And science has answered so many questions. We're so indebted to science. I often think I'm so glad to be alive now and not in the Middle Ages. It's wonderful. And the main reason I'm glad is largely because of a lot of scientific advances. So science has contributed an enormous amount. But it also, there are so many questions which remain unanswered by science. Science looks at when things happened and how they happened, but it tends to not look at the why questions. Religion tends to look at those why questions. I think it was Paul Davies that said in the lecture, You know, if you walk into a room and you see computers and you're looking at the screens and there's so much going on the screens, there's all this software running and there's images and there's emails and there's this program and there's so many things happening. If you were to say to a computer scientist, like, wow, you know, like, why is this all here and how does it all happen? Then it's possible that they would walk around to the back of the computer, take off the back cover and point to the copper wire and the bits there and say, well, that's what's powering all of this. But when we look at the complexity of a computer screen, we're not just wondering about those things that are powering behind, but we're thinking, it's a software question too. What's created this amazing amount of software? It's a very, you know, very sophisticated, complex thing, the computer system and the software that runs on it and all the functions that we have on our computers these days. And Paul Davies was making the point that when it comes to the study of the origins of the universe, really, as scientists, like, we're so excited that we've discovered carbon was a building block of life, but it's like pointing to the copper wire. There's still so much that is not known. And whilst we might know that, you know, the building block of life is carbon, who made the carbon? You know, there are so many questions by science that simply aren't answered. Science doesn't tend to answer the questions of why things happen. Why? So our deepest human questions about why were we created? Why do we exist? Do we have meaning? Do we have a purpose in life? Who made us? Those are not the questions that are answered by science. I brought along a little visual aid today, and I've got a little illustration. Again, it's from it's from John Polkinghorne, and he said he gave an illustration once about boiling a kettle, and he said, imagine you come into the room and you ask the question, the kettle's boiling on the stove, and you ask the question, why is the kettle boiling? And a scientist is going to tell you, well, because it's been heated up underneath and all the molecules are heating up and they're rising up and they're forming steam, and so it's boiling. But another person might say, the kettle is boiling because I want a cup of tea. You know, that's a response which is really looking at the final cause, whereas the science answer looks at the phenomena itself. It's a phenomenological answer. And perhaps that explains for us how both religion and science contribute to the bigger picture of what we would call truth. I have in my mind a Venn diagram, so I've got religion in one circle and science in the other, and at the center is truth, and they both make a wonderful contribution. I'll just end with two examples. So I think that the best way to view science and faith is not as if there's some power narrative going on and there's a big battle, but rather that it's a both-and situation, that they both contribute to our understanding of the world, and they will both contribute to our understanding of this virus, which not only raises scientific questions for us, but also existential questions about the role that we will play and what we ought to do morally in the situation, what we ought to do in order to look after ourselves as well as to look after our neighbours and others in the community, what we need to do to empower our scientists to find answers. But let me end with two examples. So in the 1500s was a great man of faith, Martin Luther, and he was the father of the Protestant Reformation in Germany and incredibly influential upon the Reformation altogether. And he studied at a place called Wittenberg in Germany, and in 1527 there was a plague in Wittenberg, and he wrote a 19-page tract at the time about how to respond to the plague and, you know, engage with questions about should you escape to the country if you can to get away from it. And remember, at the time, they knew very little about what what caused the plague and how it was caught, they did know that if you were in close proximity to someone with the plague, you had a high chance of getting it yourself. But I think they thought that something came out of the person's eyes, the sick person's eyes, that spread the disease. They didn't understand it, but scientists at the time did try to work out ways to address it. And anyway, Martin Luther wrote this tract, and it's a wonderful expression of balance as a Christian minister, how he thinks about the virus and how he thought about the plague, and how to respond to it. He says at one point in this very long tract, he says, "Now, firstly, I shall ask God mercifully to protect us." So first thing he says is, "I'm going to pray about this plague." But then he immediately adds, quote, "Then I shall fumigate, help purify the air, administer medicine, and take it." What a wonderful balance of both faith and of science, of listening to science, of acknowledging that the world, has an order, that it's a created order, that you need to respect that what's going on in the created order of things, and you also need to trust God for the outcome and to engage in prayer. Finally, there was another scientist who in the 1960s worked in the UK. His name was David Tyrrell, and he worked at the UK's Wiltshire Common Cold Research Unit. And he and co-workers discovered viruses in the 1960s in common cold patients whose sensitivity to ether indicated that they possessed a lipid membrane, these viruses, like those of ordinary cells, rather than the protein coats of many other viruses. And there was an image of the virus as they saw it, but of course they didn't have the best ways of viewing the virus. And it was many years later that they were observed by polymerase chain reaction technology, and he received news many years later of the confirmation of the 16 genes that he had that he had worked on originally, that they'd been confirmed by this new technology, which was able to see the virus in much more detail, and to see the little protein expressions, protein on the virus as well. And this is how he celebrated, okay? So when he heard the news, it says, he said that he celebrated by mowing the lawn while singing "Praise My Soul, the King of Heaven." What a beautiful combination, both of faith and respect for the world that God has created. So back to our question, what is the role of faith and science in this time of crisis? I want to suggest just a simple response. Firstly, in terms of our scientists, we should help them to do their very best. We should take their advice and we should pray for them. In addition to that, we should, because of our faith, play our part in the community, do the right thing, be accountable, be responsible for the flourishing of this world. We ought to be prayerful, and we ought to make sure, as Martin Luther concluded, that no matter what happened in terms of the plague, he had confidence because of Christ's victory over death. And we ought to be sure that we also have confidence in Christ's victory over death for ourselves as well. Thank you for listening.